Welcome to Amplify, the personal brand business show. Today on the show, Bob is speaking with Carol Mahoney.
You have the steering wheel. You can decide which way you're going to steer, but your buyers have the gas and the brake. They decide how fast or how slow they go. And so that's why it's a collaboration. It's because one person's steering a lot of the time. Another person is trying to go slow or fast. And it's the communication that you have that actually gets you both to the destination safely in time. I think that the other thing that happens with small business owners is this is personal. This is either our skills or our ideas. And it's different than selling a product in a company where it's not necessarily attached to you. It's a lot easier to get over that fear of rejection when it's not you and your ideas that they're rejecting.
Hi there, and welcome back to the Personal Brand and Business Show. My name is Bob Gentle, and every week I speak with amazing people who share their secrets to building, marketing, and monetizing their expertise and the mindset you need for your business to grow and thrive. If you're new to the show, then while you still have your device on your hand, take a second to subscribe. If you're on Apple Podcasts, that's the little plus icon that they've hidden in the top right just to make podcasters happy that nobody subscribes. So do hit that subscribe button. If you're on YouTube, that's a like and a subscribe and a comment if you're feeling generous. So this week, I am really excited to welcome Carol Mahoney to the show, and we're going to be talking and nerding out on sales and selling. Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And thank you for saying nerding out, because I am an inner nerd for sure.
Well, the funny thing with sales is, and you tell me if this is familiar to you, in a small business world, it's maybe different in the corporate where they have people whose sole function is sales. But in the small business world, people's answer to having to do the sales is marketing. Everybody tries to market their way to new sales. And the analogy I often use, and this can maybe orientate the conversation a little bit, is marketing, which is my main background, is about cultivating the ground. It's about sowing the crop. It's about watering. It's about nurturing and watching it grow. Sales is the harvest. And most people approach sales by walking through the orchard with a bucket, hoping an apple's going to fall in. But what they don't understand is that all the fruit is on the tree waiting for the picking as a result of all that marketing. And it frustrates the hell out of me.
I love that analogy. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I had to come to an early conclusion in my career was you can't take marketing leads to the bank. If we could, then all of us would not need to sell. And in my own personal business, I started in marketing. I had a marketing degree. I had a bad experience with sales in the corporate world and wanted nothing to do with it. There's another story there. But, you know, for me, it was, I was marketing. And I believed that with the dawn of the internet, that we were going to do such awesome marketing. We were going to obliterate the need to have the pushy, slimy, sleazy salespeople that nobody wants to be or interact with. And I had to learn the hard way that we still need to have sales. We still need to sell with people. We still need to have these conversations. And I love your analogy of a lot of small business owners go into their business because of a passion or a problem that they see that they feel something about and don't see themselves as salespeople, don't want to see themselves as salespeople. And so for them, they dive everything into marketing. And then, like you said, they're waiting for the apples to fall into their bucket, not realizing that they have to be the ones that reach out and pick that because they don't want to be seen as a salesperson. And they think that their thing that they love is going to be so awesome that everybody's just going to want it and buy it because it's a no-brainer, and it doesn't work that way either.
Well, we're going to take some steps, hopefully, to fix that for some people today. But before we get too ahead of ourselves, Carol, could you maybe just take a moment and tell us a little bit about who you are, where you are, and what you do?
So I am in the United States. I'm in Southern Maine in a little lakeside community where I live. Honestly, it's a paradise where I live. I live on a hill overlooking a lake with wildlife preserves around me. And it is, you know, it is my dream home. And I never would have thought that I would actually get to this place where I can live here and do the things that I do. And, you know, oftentimes when I do speaking and people read my bio, I have that moment where I just kind of have to pause and pinch myself. Like, this is really you. This is really your life that you daydreamed about, but never actually thought it would happen. And so, you know, today I coach at Harvard Business School for their entrepreneurial MBA program. I run an inside sales professional association called Emblaze in the Boston chapter. And I work with both startups and small business owners, as well as large companies and corporations. And as I tell my mom, when she asks what I do for a living, I say, you know what, Ma? I talk to salespeople every single day on purpose, And then she gives me this face like, what? Why? Who? You? And so for me, this is kind of the antithesis of what I thought I would be doing when I grew up. I wanted to be a teacher or a writer. I never would have thought of myself as a sales coach or trainer or even person. And so even the rest of my family is still kind of trying to scratch their heads over, how did that happen?
So let's talk about sales then, because for me, every business is essentially a value exchange. And it's how you cross that bridge between the value that you have and the person that needs it that dictates how successful you're going to be. And yet that bridge is one that everybody's totally scared of. So sales is often described as a process, a sales process. In your mind, given that you've written a book, we will talk about that. But anybody that's written a book has clearly got a process in mind. What does a healthy sales process look like in your world?
In my world, the healthy sales process is one that is aligned with and follows with the buyer's process to make a decision. One of the issues, I guess you could say, that I have with sales in general is that so much of it is focused on what we have to do, the tactics, the techniques, the strategies that we do to persuade and influence and create urgency in our buyers. And in that process, we are making it all about us. All about what we want, what we need, our products, our benefits, our steps that we need to go through. And the buyer is just kind of like this passive participant in our process. But the reality is that, you know, one of the things that I write about in the book is what I call the new golden rule, which is that those who have the gold make the rules. And that is our buyers today. And sales needs to wake up to the fact that buyers are in control. And we talk about the stats about how far buyers are the way through their sales process before they talk to a salesperson, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, human beings want other human beings to help them to make decisions. And it's that emotional connection that we have to that decision that we're not going to be able to do away with the salesperson technically. And so I look at sales as not as something that we do to other people. I'm going to persuade you. I'm going to manipulate you is what we think. Instead, it's something that we do with them. It's a collaboration. And that is what my research tells me that buyers are actually wanting today. They want someone who's going to collaborate with them, help them see differently about their problem or their solution, you know, share things with them that they might not fully know or realize so that they can feel comfortable and confident in making their decisions. But what often happens in sales processes, we have our discovery or our qualification, our presentation, demo, or proposal, and then our close. We're so focused on that, we're not paying attention to what's going on with our buyers. And so our buyers feel like they're not being listened to. They feel like it's just another number. Like you could be talking to anyone right now and you have no idea or understand me and my world and my unique challenges. And that's why sales has earned the reputation of being pushy, slimy, and sleazy, because we focus so much on what we need and what we want in the sales process and ignoring the needs of our buyer for the most part. And even though we'll say we are so buyer focused, we're customer focused, but there's actually surveys from LinkedIn that show that when they ask sellers, do you put your buyers first? And of course they said yes, but only a small fraction of their buyers actually agreed with that. And most of them said they don't understand us, they don't listen to us, they don't understand our problems and our situations. And I think that's why sales is in the state that it's in today. And it's time for us to have what I call the renaissance of sales, where we start with this is how I did it at my last company, and start with here's what the science and research and behavior research says about how people make decisions and how I need to be able to adjust to that. And the other thing is sales, not even sales, making decisions is not a linear process. You're a marketer, and so you may have seen how the heat maps that people do on a website page, there's nothing linear about that. And that's indicative of how we make decisions. We're making our decisions based off of emotions. We like to think that we're making decisions logically and in a process and, you know, going through all of our due diligence. But the reality is we just want someone to help us feel that we're making the right decision and that we're going to get the kinds of results from that decision that we're looking for.
So we can get into that in a minute. And I think what I'd like to maybe look at is, so with opportunity, we'll put it that way, opportunity can come through one of four doors. It can come through ads. It can come through content and content marketing. It can come through our network and our relationships. Or it can come through outbound activity. So the last two are relationships and our network. Well, I guess content, and relationships. These are people who know of us, or they've been referred to us, and they've decided they have a need before we encounter them. So this is inbound sales.
Right.
Outbound sales go knocking on doors and saying, would you like to buy my thing? With inbound, superficially, it seems quite easy to be customer-led because they've put their hand up and said, I'd like to have a conversation about your stuff. So I'm going to put that on the straightforward chair for a moment. The outbound sales activity, how do you approach that in a way that's customer-led?
So one of the ways that I teach people to do an outbound activity is to, instead of going in with the pitch, I have this great thing. I think that you would be interested in it. It's still a focus on me. I think you want, and instead using a collaborative nature to that and sharing, you know, like, for example, you know, a lot of the CEOs that I talk to are struggling with this and don't realize that this is what's actually going on behind it. How do you view that? Or how do you see yourself handling that in your organization? Would you be open to a 10-minute or a 15-minute conversation to explore if there's some, you know, possibilities there? Or, you know, I do a lot of work with startup founders. I'm working with one startup founder now who is going after a demographic that they're not on social media. They don't generally answer their phones. They kind of ignore their email. And so for them, it's a real challenge as to how they're going to be able to reach out to these people to capture their attention. And, you know, for a startup founder where you're starting to build your product, you're starting to understand what the problems are that you're solving, seeking feedback and advice from your buyers is one way to reach out to them in a way that actually asks for their opinions. And it sounds simply like, you know, I'm thinking about this particular problem in our industry, and I think I might have a solution to build for it, but you're an expert in this. I would love to have your feedback and thoughts on what we're building and what you'd like to see us build. That's one example where you, as a startup founder or a small business owner who's just starting out, can start to collaborate with people. But if you're working at a company and maybe you already have a set product or something along those lines, using content or, you know, offering value to them in a way like, you know, maybe coming to a panel or a webinar or something along those lines to learn some more about a particular thing versus going in with the hard pitch, we have this, you need to talk to us, which most people are turned off by even before the internet, but most people are still turned off by when nobody wants to be interrupted. But they will be willing to be interrupted if there's something that captures their attention, something that is relative to what they're dealing with right now. And so one of the things that I emphasize in the book and in my trainings is that you need to do your research. You need to do your homework to embed yourself inside of the world of that particular buyer so that you can have the empathy for them to understand where they might be and where they might be coming from and where they're trying to get to. Instead, what I see happen is people get a list. They start, you know, pummeling that list with outbound sequences or LinkedIn messages. I'm so-and-so. I have this. I know that you're interested in this because you're a small business owner. I can't even tell you how many of those I get in a day. Mm. It's not working. It's actually pushing people away. And so when people are seeking collaboration, they're seeking new thoughts, they're seeking new ideas. And so using your outbound motion to be able to do that. And I know that you said there's inbound and there's outbound, but honestly, I think it's a combination of the two. It's creating the content that is going to appeal to people in the situations that they're in, and then going outbound with that. Because if you're sitting and waiting for them to find it, good luck with that. But usually a proactive approach to put that in front of the people who you think is going to be most valuable with, asking for their input and their feedback on that. You know, what are you seeing? How are you attacking this particular thing? Is a better approach that appeals to people than the pushy spamminess.
What's really interesting listening to that is the more of a content creator you are, the more opportunity you have to interact in that manner. If you don't want to engage in any form of creativity or content creation, you're really going to struggle.
Yeah.
And
there's so many ways to create content. Like, I work with people who I don't like to write. They don't feel like they're comfortable on video yet. And, you know, I was just talking with someone yesterday who was in that kind of situation. I don't have time to create content. I don't have time to figure out how to blog. I don't have time to like sit down and do a video. But if you have someone who can do that and you can be kind of the muse that gives them the raw content, then that's one way that you can create content without having to take the time to figure out how to do it. But as an expert, you have all of this knowledge, and maybe you just need to find someone that helps to draw that out of you so that you can then leverage that. honestly, that's what I do because I don't have time to create all of the videos that I do. I have my person, Alyssa, who I said, here, this is for you now to slice and dice. You know, I've worked with her and trained with her so that she understands my brand and my voice and my message. You know, she's read my book, I don't know how many times, but that's one way for small business owners to be able to do that. And if you're a salesperson in a company, you have an entire marketing team creating this content for you. And if you're doing your job well in your sales conversations, you should be gaining all kinds of insights that you can feed back to your marketing team to say, what kind of content do we have around this particular conversation? And then use that in your outbound sequences and in your follow-ups and your nurturing sequences.
So there are a couple of key points that people struggle with in sales, in my experience. The first one is starting conversations. And we've kind of discussed that a little bit. Going from complete stranger to we're now talking. The next stage people often struggle with when they're not experienced in sales is pivoting or segueing that conversation into a clearly defined, okay, we're talking business now. This is a sales conversation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, when that's not done well, it's not done with permission. I guess, how would you, the easy way to ask is, how do you train people to do that pivot, to make that migration from just chatting to, do you mind if we talk about our product?
Yeah. So it's a transition that happens. And so say, for example, you're having a conversation with someone. I'll use our conversation as an example. So we're talking about the different aspects of sales and the different ways to put people into the top of the funnel. It sounds like that this is something that might be a challenge for you. What are some of the things that you've already tried to overcome this challenge? And what is it about those things that have worked for you? And what do you feel hasn't worked? And why do you think that is? And going down this conversation to really dig deeper into understanding how they're getting to the conclusions that they're getting or why they're facing the challenges that they're facing and where they feel that comes from, you've already started a discovery conversation, which is a sales conversation. And so then transitioning that into, you know, it sounds like these things have been a challenge for you for a while and it's impacting your ability to grow the sales in your business, which is, you know, and your goal is to be able to support your family. Would you be open to having a conversation about how we help people to do that and set up that conversation then? And you might even say something like, you know, because you said that sales isn't something that comes naturally to you, I wonder if you've ever done any training on that before. Would you be open to having a conversation about what that might look like? And it's asking the permission, but then it's also summarizing what they've heard. And if you can, adding some insights into that. You know, I hear a lot of small business owners that I talk with, they started it because they have a passion for this particular problem and solution. But then when it comes to sales, they have never been trained on it before, like you. And a lot of people, when they get into business, they don't see sales as something that's a natural skill set for them. And they feel like it's pushy and slimy and sleazy. But the reality is that sales is an exchange of value. And if you think of sales as a collaboration, how does that make you feel about going into a sales conversation now? And so kind of summarizing what you've heard and offering them some insights and following it up with a diagnostic question to understand what their thoughts and opinions are on something. The thing of it is that people actually enjoy answering those types of open-ended questions that ask them to share what it is that they think. In a study from Harvard, they actually did some fMRI, so the magnetic imaging of our brains, to see how people reacted when they are asked these kinds of open-ended questions where they are asked to state their opinions. And the thing that happens in our brains is it lights up the part of our brains where we form reward and pleasure and relationships and trust. We get dopamine that releases in our brains when we start talking about ourselves. That dopamine then leads to oxytocin. And that's what helps us to build trust and relationships with other people. That's what makes us feel good. And so transitioning that conversation to get them to share more about what they want and what they think actually starts the beginning of building trust and relationships with that individual. And so when you suggest, would you be open and having a conversation to dig into this more? They're like, yeah, I would love to dig into this more because now my brain's all lit up with dopamine and I want to talk about this even more.
I think that dopamine, if it's the right conversation, it's hard to overemphasize how impactful that can be.
Yeah.
I think it's really interesting listening to you talk there that one of the worries people have with sales is what happens if people say no? What happens if I'm rejected? Mm-hmm. And what's clear is the way you describe that, it's been practiced. And you only get the practice through the repetition. Mm-hmm. And so that rejection becomes an important part of the process, because nobody's going to say yes all the time. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So you need to suck it up. And it's like going to learn to play tennis. I'm going to hit the ball all over the place. That's got to be okay, because that's the price of getting good.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you've got the ideal customer on the call and they really do need what you've got, you're going to come across as natural because you've practiced. And that's so important. So the failure actually becomes really important.
Yeah, it is absolutely critical to practice. You know, one of the things that I tell my salespeople and my business owners that I work with is, do not practice on your prospects. Do not practice on the people that you want to actually have a good conversation with. And I also say this, everything that we do in life is selling. We are all salespeople, whether you're the parent trying to convince the child to eat their vegetable, or the child trying to convince the parent to buy them the toy, or the spouse trying to convince the parent, you know, all of these things that we do in life are sales. And so we've been doing this our entire life, but that also means that we can practice our sales conversations in our everyday conversations. So I actually had a client of mine once who had a debilitating fear of rejection. And one of the things that I encouraged him to do was to go out and seek ways to be rejected in everyday life so that he could get used to that and to build that muscle. And so I had him go out and stand, like, you know, at the mall and ask people if they'd like to have a cup of coffee with him. And after being rejected after that so many times, he was like, okay, this is not a big deal. Like, my dog still loves me. Like, life still goes on just because someone said no. It's not the end of the world. And I think the other part of being able to handle the rejection in sales is to be able to truly understand your own value and not seeking approval from other people, but seeking approval from the people in your life that actually matter, your family, your friends, yourself. And that's, you know, just one way that everyday life activities that we can do that are going to help us in our sales conversations. You know, another thing that I teach and train to a lot is the ability to actively listen and ask good open-ended questions, which seems very simple. But when you get into these high pressure situations, you need this deal to close, you need this ideal buyer to be able to buy from you, all of that pressure creates an emotional involvement in it. And it makes us start thinking to ourselves in our heads. And when that happens, we are not able to actively listen. And when we're not actively listening, those good questions that we should be asking don't come to us because we're too busy listening to the voice in our head, or reacting to the objection, or reacting to the buying signals that it seems like they're excited. And so practicing in our everyday lives of ways to manage our emotions, whether that's through yoga or meditation or exercise, there's a lot of ways that we can manage our emotions in our day-to-day, or being able to be handling our own need for approval, to be seen a certain way, and seeking validation, not from others, but from ourselves and from those that are close to us. These are small ways that we can practice in our sales conversations so that when we get into these conversations, we're not hindered by these beliefs and mindsets that are going to get in our way of doing the things that we know we should do, we know that we can do, but somehow in that moment, we either forget or we chicken out. Like, we think of that question that's a little prickly, maybe a little tough to ask, and we chicken out because we don't want to upset the person, because people need to like me in order to buy from me, we believe. And so the practice piece of this is something that we need to integrate into our everyday lives in order for us to improve it in our sales conversations. And that was one of the things that, you know, if there was one thing I wish I had learned early on, it was probably that.
I think so many of us have our sense of identity and other people's feelings very, very closely bonded. And I think if you are in the situation where you're going to have to do proactive outbound selling, desensitizing yourself to that and taking a step back and understanding this is not about you and them, this is about the process. And your job as the person whose job is sales is to be the guardian of the process. The relationships, if they're good, are a byproduct of that. But your self-worth isn't measured by how people in your sales pipeline necessarily feel about you. Obviously, you want
a lot of times I describe the sales process with business owners as you're not the one necessarily in control. Like, think of it as if you're driving a car. You have the steering wheel. You can decide which way you're going to steer, but your buyers have the gas and the brake. They decide how fast or how slow they go. And so that's why it's a collaboration. It's because one person's steering a lot of the time. Another person is trying to go slow or fast. And it's the communication that you have that actually gets you both to the destination safely in time.
Yeah.
I think that the other thing that happens with small business owners is this is personal. This is either our skills or our ideas. And it's different than selling a product in a company where it's not necessarily attached to you. It's a lot easier to get over that fear of rejection when it's not you and your ideas that they're rejecting.
Yeah.
And so to be able to disassociate ourselves from our business and that it's not necessarily our identities, that's a hard thing for a lot of business owners to do, but it's absolutely critical for you to be successful in sales. I have this t-shirt that I'm wearing. So if you're listening, it's a t-shirt that has upside down written on it, not about me. So that the person who's wearing the shirt can look down and see and be reminded of that fact that it's not about me. And it's not about my process. It's not about my product. It's about the needs of the buyer. And the thing that happens is that when you do fully realize that it's not about you, it's actually freedom. Freedom from the fear of rejection, freedom from the nomenclature of what are they going to think of me and how are they going to judge me types of things. And it also gives you the freedom to say things that maybe you wouldn't have said before because you would have chickened out by asking that tough question. And it's that reminder that it is all about the buyer because they're the ones who have the problem. And so if you care more about this sale and this problem than they do, that should be a red flag.
Yeah. On the topic of red flags, as we've described, sales in its essence is a process. And processes, as much as we like to humanize them, thrive on rules. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious to hear from you, what are your key maxims in terms of the rules of the road in the sales pipeline? What are your absolute do's and don'ts?
So these are my red flags. These are the things that if these red flags pop up, then there's some concern as to the viability of this opportunity. The first one is if you're not talking to the decision maker at some point in the sales process. It's, you know, let's take inbound leads, for example. Most of the time, 99.9% of the time, it's not going to be the person who's going to be making the decision that's the inbound lead. It's typically going to be a manager or an end user or an influencer or a champion who wants to learn more. And they're trying to build some type of internal business case in order to make some type of a change happen. And what a lot of people do, especially small business owners, is they focus on that one person who's their champion to be able to run the rest of the process with them. If that person's not willing at some point to introduce you to the economic decision maker, that is a huge red flag because it is not the same perspective between a decision maker a lot of times and the end user or the influencer. Like if you think about, you know, managers or directors or people who are in particular roles, they're focused on either their day-to-day or how they're going to look in the organization or something along those lines. They have different priorities versus a CEO or a CFO or a COO who's really more focused on high-level business aspects of things. They're not worried so much about the day-to-day. And if they're the ones who has to make a decision on something and we're not getting them involved in the process before we deliver a proposal, we're not going to win that proposal. What's going to happen is you're going to get all of these back and forth going on because you didn't include them in the conversation. So that's my number one red flag. My other red flags are what I call in the jolt effect, they call it the ability to decide. A lot of deals get lost to no decision. They not so much because they want to stay with the status quo, but because they're afraid of making the wrong decision. It's one thing to have to deal with bad circumstances because that's the way that it is. It's another thing to have to deal with bad circumstances because of a decision that you made. Now it's your fault. And buyers and decision makers don't want to make a bad decision that's going to reflect badly on them. And so some of the red flags on people's ability to decide is that they don't understand their own decision-making criteria as to how they're going to decide, or they don't have a timeline that they're going to decide, or they don't know what the goals and results that they're looking for are in order for them to decide. If you're not able to uncover that with your buyers during the sales and buying process, those are red flags that tell me they're never going to make a decision because they don't have the ability to, because they don't have anything to decide by or a reason to decide. There's no compelling reasons for them to make a change. And those are the biggest red flags that I see. A lot of people will say objections are a red flag. I actually think objections are good things because if someone's sharing an objection with you, it's because they're thinking about making the purchase, but this is the thing that's standing in their way. And a lot of times sellers get nervous when they hear objections because they don't know how to respond to them. It's an emotional defensive reaction. Our lizard brain starts to kick in. And then we start telling them about why they should and why they're wrong about their objection. instead of being able to calmly say, you know what, I totally understand why you feel that way. And a lot of people who I talk to also feel that way. But what they don't realize is X, Y, and Z. And you shared with me that A, B, and C is really important to you in order for you to achieve this particular goal. And so reframing objections with people is about being able to understand where it is that that's coming from and saying, you know what, you have a valid point there, but did you know this or had you considered that? And you had shared that this was important is a different way to handle those objections. And one of the things that I like to say to people is if your buyers aren't bringing up objections, then you need to bring them up. And in fact, if you can bring up an objection before your buyer does, you're immediately starting to build trust with them because you're not just telling them what they want to hear. You're saying, you know what? I talk to a lot of people who want to increase their sales. However, a lot of times what happens is that they don't necessarily have the time to devote to improving their sales. What does your schedule look like and how you're going to be able to integrate some of the coaching that we're going to be able to do together on a weekly basis? Because otherwise, this might not be the best solution for you. And maybe you want to consider doing something else like this instead. When we bring up the objection, now we're telling them something else that they hadn't fully realized or considered before that none of the other salespeople that they've talked to have brought up before, instant trust. And also then being able to create a plan where how are we going to move around this objection or how are we going to work through this obstacle if and when it should show up in your process? Now you have a plan with them of how to move forward with that. Now you don't have to deal with whatever delay might happen as a result.
What's really interesting listening to that is if you're the kind of business owner that's depending on people coming to you, every mm-hmm. single person that you speak to feels critical. But if you have a process around regularly prospecting new opportunity proactively, mm-hmm. then every lead, every opportunity becomes far less critical. So you can afford to relax into the process a little bit.
Yeah.
And in a lot of small businesses, prospecting is just not a thing. How mm-hmm. do you encourage people to actually begin that whole thing of prospecting? And in your philosophy, maybe define prospecting for the listener.
Yeah. So for me, prospecting is essentially reaching out to people to see if they have a problem that you can help with. That's it. If they don't have a problem that you can help with, then there's no reason for you to continue the conversation unless you just really like talking to them. I look at it this way, is you either are the kind of person who's going to see somebody carrying a bunch of things in their hand, trying to walk down the sidewalk, and then they trip and fall and twist their ankle. You have two choices. You're either going to be the kind of person who stops what they're doing and goes over to ask or offer help for them, even if they don't raise their hand for it, or you're going to be the kind of person who walks by and waits for them to raise their hand. I think of prospecting as the person who's going to go over to someone who sees someone struggling and say, can I help? Versus the person that's just going to wait for them to raise their hand to ask, because if they didn't ask, then they don't need help. Not necessarily true. And so it's almost our ethical responsibility to reach out to people to see if they need help with things, because that's what we're here for, to help each other. That's what makes the world a better place. And so prospecting, again, it's not about you. It's about them. And if they don't have a problem, that's okay. You move on to the next one. And the way that I typically have people start with it, it's like any behavior change. You want to start with something small that you can build off of. So if you're not doing any prospecting today, then the simplest way to start is just pick one person that you're going to reach out to today. It's one more person than you reached out to yesterday. And then the next day, you do it again. Maybe you add two more people that you're going to reach out to. And so every day you start building on that. It's like exercise. You don't start off lifting 125 pounds. You start off lifting maybe 3 pounds or 5 pounds. And you start to build that up over time. And as your muscles get stronger, you're able to do more. And then it becomes a habit. Every day you do exercise, you start to get used to the habit and how you feel about that. So that on the days that you don't do it, you actually feel like there's something missing. Like, I didn't get a chance to do my yoga yet this morning. And so I'm kind of like, I feel like there's something missing in my routine because I've been doing it every day for the past 3.5 years. And so that's how I look at prospecting is one, are you the kind of person who's going to reach out to someone and ask if they need help or are you going to wait? And then the second thing is starting small and building that habit up over a period of time.
I think that's really, really good advice. It's like a lot of the things that drive excellence mm-hmm. are uncomfortable. Most yeah. people avoid them. And so you need to desensitize yourself to the things that for most people are unusual or uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And very quickly, yep. they become kind of normal. In fact, they become yep. part of your routine and you miss them when they're not there. It's really, really good.
In psychology, they call it the exposure technique, right? We're going to expose you to the thing that makes you uncomfortable in small little pieces at a time until it becomes something that you're now comfortable with. I do public speaking. I used to have debilitating stage fright, like debilitating as in couldn't sleep for the nights before, would be so nervous and shaky. I sounded like Kermit the Frog on the call or the phone or whatever it was that I was doing. But it was by slowly exposing myself to that, getting some training and coaching on that, dealing with the mindsets and beliefs that were behind that, that made me be comfortable on stage. And not only comfortable, I actually have fun on stage now. Like I'm not nervous and I'm not shaking. I can actually laugh. If something goes wrong, it's not a big deal. And that was something that took me several years to build up that muscle for, but I had to start exposing myself to it in small ways to get there.
Again, brilliant advice that I'm actually taking personally on the speaking side of things. It's my next monster to slay. You've written a book. I haven't had any conversation about the book yet, and I'll feel like a real, we need to speak about the book. So can you tell me a little bit about your book, Buyer First?
So this was a book that I wrote. I've been trying to write this book for 12 years. And, you know, I had an idea of what it was that I wanted to write about. And I struggled and struggled and struggled. And then I heard AJ Harper, who runs a book writing workshop, say that a book isn't about something. A book is for someone. And it was kind of this light bulb moment for me, because I tell people all the time, it's not about you. It's about your buyer. It's about, for her, it's not about you. It's all about your reader. And so at the moment that I decided who this book was for, it made it much easier for me to start writing this book. And honestly, this book was the book that I wish that I had 20 years ago when I first started my business. Because, you know, you can kind of see that I have this bookshelf behind me that of all of these different types of sales and marketing books. The problem is that most of these books are written for people who work inside of companies, with the exception of some of the marketing books, because small business owners see marketing as sales. And there were no sales books written for the small business owner who has to do the selling and the delivering themselves, or the startup founder who has to do the selling to develop the product. And what was happening was that, you know, we had said before, selling in a company is different than selling yourself in a business. And I struggled with sales. No matter how many sales books I read, I couldn't understand why it wasn't working for me. And so this is a book that I wrote for the small business owner who has to sell, doesn't necessarily see themselves as a salesperson, maybe even sees sales pushy and slimy and sleazy. How do they go about actually starting to do that? And so I spent a good 10 years doing some research, testing that research on myself, testing that research on my clients, to then come up with what I call the collaborative selling framework of how we can engage with buyers in a way that they actually like, that they actually will engage and enjoy and start to move things forward. And so this is a book that really talks about how selling isn't something that we do to other people. It's something that we do with them. And that sales isn't just a numbers game. It's a mental game. And so dealing with the mental side of sales, because how we think about things becomes how we do things. And if we can change how we think about things, then we can do things differently. We can get better results. And that's the thing that I wanted to focus on in this book. It's not necessarily always about what you do, but how you think about what you do that's going to make the difference. And that was the thing that made the difference for me. And I wanted to be able to share that for people, because I knew, like, with the pandemic happening and so many people had left the workforce and so many of those people went and started their own businesses, I knew that they were going to come up against the same roadblock that I did, where they had to decide, do I figure out how to sell or do I go get a job? And for me, job was a four-letter word that I just didn't want to go down again.
I hear you there. I think your ability to sell is really what will make or break a business. No sales, no business. And
exactly.
For me, it makes me really sad that I see amazing, inspiring, really delightful people not thriving purely down to because of how they feel about sales. It's not about mm-hmm. their ability. It's about the mindset. So I think you've hit the nail right on the head with the book. I'm waiting for my copy to arrive. It's not here yet.
When it does. Well, and the thing is there's so many books out there that talk about mindset, growth mindset, you know, XYZ mindset. The thing that was missing from those books, and I love, like, Carol Dweck's book, Growth Mindset, one of my favorite books. But the thing that I struggled with in that book is it doesn't tell me necessarily how to change it. And I know that we can change our minds. I know that we can change our belief systems. And so that's what I really wanted to dig into, was how do we go about actually starting to change our mindsets towards sales so that we can adopt the behaviors that buyers value? And in digging into that, I found that there's a couple of steps that we need to take. I call it a cognitive behavioral approach to sales performance, because cognitive behavioral approach is about addressing the negative beliefs that we have towards something and changing them into a positive one. And if we can do that for ourselves, we can do that with our buyers. And there's a couple of steps that are involved. The first one is, and I know when I say this, there's going to be some eye rolling that happens out there on the interwebs. But the very first step to that is setting your own personally meaningful goals. Just as you would need to do with your buyers to find out what their goals are to make a change, you need to identify what your goals are and why they matter to you in order for you to make this change. I mean, I don't know a business owner out there who doesn't want to get more clients. But that's obviously not enough of a personally meaningful goal for us to make a change. Otherwise, every business owner out there would be excellent at sales. And then the other part of that is doing through a specific process in setting those goals. So thinking about them, writing them down, creating action commitments of what we're going to do or learn or overcome in order to make that happen. Sharing it with someone else that we'll hold ourselves accountable to and make regular reports to. And in all of my research, I found that people who do that are 298% more likely to be top sellers. 298% just by going through this exercise. And the other thing that was interesting in that analysis I did is that those people had 32% more selling skills than those who hadn't gone through that exercise. So setting these goals is what allows us or motivates us to actually start learning some more skills. And then the other step I found that was critical in us changing our mindsets is to become aware of where they're coming from. I call it like digging into your sales origin story. Like, we've all had those experiences with salespeople that have given us a nasty taste in our mouth. But it's actually examining what that is and how it shows up for you and where it comes from and what the belief system is around that. And then doing some cognitive behavioral techniques around that to start to shift how we see those things. And then the third step was really getting specific on what are the mindsets that are getting in my way. You know, one of the reasons I think that people struggle so much to get healthy and lose weight is because we're told we need to exercise more. We need to eat more vegetables. But the problem with that is that's such generalized big picture advice that it's hard for us to apply because it's not specific to us. It's the difference between telling someone, you know what, you need to exercise more and you need to spend 15 minutes doing yoga every day. It's very specific.
Yeah.
And so with our sales mindsets, it's being specific about what is the mindset that's getting in my way. How is it getting in my way? What's the belief system behind that? And how do I replace that belief system to change the mindset to adopt the behavior? So that's really what I dug into the book, and then combined that with how do people make decisions today? We talk about, you know, the research about how people react when we ask certain questions, about how they make their decisions. And by combining these two things together, what I've been hearing from my readers, I had someone email me just the other day, said, you just helped me to save my business. And that's the reason why I wrote the book. Yeah, you know, I wanted to help people, but when I get messages like that, that's when the dopamine in my brain starts to light up.
I think it's one of the things that I keep coming back to again and again is that when you grow, your business will grow. And that's fundamental for sales.
Yeah. You can't be a good salesperson if you're not a good person. And becoming a good salesperson, it changed me. I say this often, but when I started going through this process for myself, I realized the impact it was starting to make even before I started getting better at sales, when my kids came to me and said, you know what, Mom, you yell a lot less than you used to. And I was like, kind of cryy and weepy at the same time. But that's when I realized that how this is impacting my personal life is also going to be the thing that impacts my professional life.
I can see that from a couple of perspectives. On the one perspective, that doing the work on yourself is going to mellow you.
Yeah.
It also speaks to the stress business owners are under when they can't feed themselves.
Exactly.
And that's heartbreaking.
It is. And that was something that I had to go through. Like, when I first started my business, it was kind of in revenge from getting laid off during the Great Recession. And I thought, I'm going to get my revenge becoming wildly successful. And instead, I found myself the week before Christmas with the cashier at the grocery store telling me that my card was declined and all the groceries were going to have to go back. I had to figure out how to sell something and fast. And it is that stress that our family, God love my family and my husband for what they put up with me when I was going through those years of trying to figure all of this out. I don't know how they didn't just like suffocate me in my sleep sometimes.
So one thing I would like to speak about before we end is that something like writing a book is one of these flagships on the personal brand business building journey. And I'm curious to hear from you as somebody who's done it and very active in promoting it, and it seems to be doing well, what kind of identity shift that has led to in you before book and you after book. What impact has that had?
Huge impact. I'll start with the personal impact first, because, you know, we were just talking about how getting better at sales impacts you, personally and professionally. What I found in writing a book, it was one of the biggest personal changes that I had to go through. You know, one of the mindsets that I talk about in the book is our need for approval and how that gets in our way of showing up authentically. And when we have a need for approval, we tend to tell people what we think that they want to hear so that they'll like us or they'll see us in a certain way, which doesn't lend itself to being transparent and authentic. And we all have these hangups. I had this hangup. And so when I was writing the book, and the reason I struggled with writing the book was because of this need for approval. And as I started writing the book and really started writing, like, you know, the story of me standing in front of the grocery clerk a week before Christmas with no money, like, as I was starting to write these stories in the book, I was kind of like, well, aren't people just going to think I'm like this loser and like this pathetic person who can't get their stuff together? Like, all of these thoughts were racing through my brain. I wrote it anyway. I mean, and there were times where I wrote some of the stories in there and I was like a weeping, sobbing mess because I was reliving it again. And I remember the day that I sent it, it was in September. I sent the first version of the manuscript to the publisher. And I remember just sitting there and like, I'm about to send this to complete strangers. And then I realized I'm about to send this to complete strangers across the world. So here we go. And it was in that moment that that need for approval started to wither and die on the vine, because at this point I'm like, I am literally an open book. There's really not anything in there that you're going to find isn't true in me now. And so that process really changed my ability to see myself in a different light. The other thing that I found that happened after publishing the book, yes, it was a huge accomplishment. This is something I've been wanting to do since I was 12 years old, is write a book. And so being able to do that, I slept better at night because it wasn't haunting me anymore. But then the other part of it that I've started to realize just in the last couple of weeks is how much it's broadened the horizons of people that I can help. I've traditionally worked in, you know, SaaS technology and professional services, but now I find that this has been applied to people in, like, just a couple of weeks ago, I was speaking with the largest funeral services company in America. Like, that's not a demographic of or a type of company that I would have normally gone after, but it's something that appealed to them. And so I have found that it has appealed to such a wider range of different companies and different industries that's opened up a whole other world for me. And it's kind of revived me again in my own business, because I'm starting to see what kind of an impact that this can have in other ways and other places that I never would have thought before. And, you know, when people message me still and say that the impact that the book had on them, it's still kind of like that Christmas morning moment for me where I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, I never would have thought of it that way, or I would never would have thought that it would apply to this way for someone. And so those, I think, are the personal things that have happened to me as a result of it. And on the branding side, you know, obviously the following has increased and the email list has increased. The number of clients and opportunities that have come to me have increased. But I think for me, the most important part of it is how I feel about it myself and the impact that it's making on other people. Because I actually had a girlfriend ask me just like a month before the book was published. She's like, so how do you feel about this? She's like, are you proud? And I said, you know what? Honestly, I feel relieved, because we all want to know that the work that we do has a positive impact in the world. And the feedback that I'm getting from people already before the book is even launched, because I had advanced readers, tells me that I'm on track to make that impact. And I started crying because it was something that was so personal to me. But at the same time, I realized that, you know, this is kind of I told my husband, this is my, if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, insurance that people can learn from my own mistakes.
I think there's probably an aspect as well that, like, much when you put on clothes that you feel really smart in, you do things you wouldn't otherwise have done. You're more confident. You carry yourself kind of differently. That must be affecting how you approach your own sales now, in terms of pitching yourself for things you perhaps wouldn't have previously, maybe being a little bit more courageous because you feel like you present differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have noticed that my sales conversations have gotten much more interesting because a lot of times they've read the book before they talk to me. And I actually was on a sales conversation just the other day and I said, well, I feel a little bit on the hot seat right now because you know all of my tricks and tactics. So, and it was just funny. Like I would ask a certain question, like, is that on page so-and-so? I'm like, yes, it is.
A book is really one of the pinnacles of content and content marketing. And one of the nice things about that that you allude to is by the time people come to you, they've already decided they like you. And yeah. That does make the sales conversation much more natural and much, much easier a lot of the time.
Yeah, it definitely makes it much faster for sure. I think I'm still getting used to that. I mean, it's only been about 6 months since I launched the book. And so I'm excited to see the other ways that people are going to apply this and what they take away from it. But, you know, and also how it's impacting my own sales and my own business. Like where, you know, right now we're trying to figure out how are we going to scale this thing? Because right now it's just me and a small team. So we need to figure out how are we going to be able to get more this into more people's hands without me working 80 hours a week.
We can talk after. When I meet people that present as outrageously competent, and you do, I have to ask the question, where in your business do you actually struggle? Where are things a bit of a car crash? You don't have to go
Let's
that
see.
Far.
I'm trying to decide which one to share. You know, one of the things that's a bit of a car crash for me right now, I think is, I mean, cash flow is always something that's tough. Writing a book is expensive and it is a big investment both in time and money. So cash flow is always a challenge, which I actually have been able to recently rectify that. But I think for me right now, the biggest challenge is the time challenge where that like I only have so much time in a day. I'm trying to be healthy and to take good care of myself so that I don't burn out or get sick every time I go somewhere, which is still a challenge. And so that's really the challenge for me is where trying to decide what are the pieces that I can't quite let go of yet and what are the pieces that I need to find someone else to be able to take over for me. And so I think, you know, one of the things that I'm looking at is hiring a virtual assistant or someone who is going to be kind of like my handles the travel, handles all of the, you know, the ins and outs and the administrative side of things, but then also can handle, you know, like when I'm gone and I'm, you know, on a stage somewhere or I'm on a plane somewhere, having someone who's like my, you know, the Robin to my Batman, who can pick up some of the pieces and slack of types of things. And I think the other thing that's the biggest struggle for me, my husband retires in 5 years. I'm building up a speaking business as a result of this. And so then it's like, okay, what do I do with the training and coaching side of the business? How do I continue to grow and scale that? Do I go the route of hiring trainers and having employees? Do I go the route of doing a certification process to have other entrepreneurs be able to do this? Or is there a third option out there somewhere that I'm not even quite aware of yet? And so it's that planning the exit strategy piece for one part of the business, that's a really big challenge right now, because I don't have a clear insight as to what the best directions to go in. And I find that this is also the challenge that seasoned small business owners have is, okay, I've gotten the success and I think I know how to scale it, but I don't know how to make it not be dependent on me yet. Mm.
Yeah, that's the universal problem of a successful solopreneur business.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know yet. I haven't made the decision yet, and I'm still exploring the options. So if you're listening and you have some ideas for me, I'm more than willing to listen.
Well, I think I have a referral for you.
Oh, good.
Anyway, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'm really grateful for your time. If somebody's listening and they're thinking, I need to get me some more Carol Mahoney, where can they find out more about you?
So you can definitely find me on LinkedIn. There's only a couple of other Carol Mahoneys on LinkedIn that spell their name the exact same way that I do. The other place that you can find me is on my speaker website, which is carolmahoney.com. Carol with an E at the end, Mahoney with an E before the Y. Those are probably the two best places to find me. You'll have, you know, there are forms there. If you, you know, one of the links I think that we're going to share with everyone is the book order page. And then on that page, there is a form that if once you've purchased the book, we're going to be doing monthly group sessions, like a Q&A group coaching kind of thing, where you can ask me anything and I will give you whatever advice that I can for absolutely for free. It's an hour long once a month. So if you want to talk to me directly, that's probably the easiest way.
So Carol, I guess that does leave us my last question, which is what's one thing you do now that you wish you'd started 5 years ago?
Speaking, definitely. I wish I had started doing that sooner because it's opened up so many doors. And, you know, I had to go through a process to learn how to be a speaker. You know, one of my favorite organizations is a company called Heroic, where they really dive deep into the speaking side of things. And so shout out to Amy and Michael Port there. I wish I had done that sooner because like writing, I actually wrote the book as a result of people who I met through that organization and that program. And so I wished I had done it sooner. I actually was one of those things where I had gone to one of their group kind of sessions and thought at the time that this was out of reach for me, and then decided 3 or 4 years later that I'm just going to take the leap. I wish I had taken the leap sooner.
I've read all of Michael Port's books, and he is a legend in my world. So
yeah,
kudos for that. It's not something I've done yet. Carol Mahoney, you have been very generous with your time. It's been lovely to meet you. I will almost certainly have you back again sometime. If you'll come.
Absolutely.
But for now, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's been my pleasure. So that does bring us to the end of another episode. I hope you at home have enjoyed listening to it or watching on YouTube. Like, subscribe, and comment. If you did enjoy listening to it, then I would invite you to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to podcasts. And I don't say this very often, but if you are listening thinking, you know what, I'd like to look at growing my personal brand business, you will also love the Personal Brand Business Roadmap. It's 50 pages of everything you need to start, scale, or fix your expert business completely free as a gift from me. Just visit amplifyme.agency/roadmap. Carol Mahoney, you've been awesome. Thank you very much, everyone at home, for listening, and see you next time.
Bye, everyone.